Okay. First thing we really should do is applaud the recent events that's been taking place, where for the first time in a very long time, working people are now far more combative against the capitalist employers. This week we saw teachers, civil servants, university staff, the supposed middle class that we've always correctly described as a myth, take strike action. 500,000 workers were apparently on strike. There appears to be a new confidence in their industrial muscle via their trade union power. Perhaps it's a result of being encouraged to view themselves as essential workers during the pandemic who kept the economy and society running. But now they are also being the victims of the cost of living rises that have happened since then. What is promising is that the employers' attempts to turn public opinion against the strikers have failed pretty miserably. The smears have fallen on stony ground, and in fact, it is the government ministers and the employers who have been having to defend their role in causing the strikes by their intransigence and by not negotiating in good faith with the unions. Overall, people have had sympathy with those on strike. And I think this is because they understand from their own personal experience the problems of cancelled or late trains, the long hospital waiting times, the slow ambulance response times, the crowded classrooms, the delayed letters, and understand these all existed without the strikes taking place. The nurses and the teachers are not being seen as the militant troublemakers as the miners and the NUM were seen during the 1980s. People are all suffering from the same pain of inflationary prices and their fallen spending power. And people can relate to the pay demands, and they don't think them as extortionate or over the top. But the government's propaganda is to take a small number of senior experienced staff in health or education as a standard and suggest that all employees receive the same generous pay. The rail workers of RMT are often accused of being overpaid by constant reference to the wages of the train drivers who are in a separate union, ASLEF, who, as I see, possess just as much responsibility as an airline pilot with hundreds of lives dependent on their training and skills, and therefore they deserve to be a high-paid occupation. However, RMT represents the lower-paid railway workers, such as the carriage cleaners. But the real reason that the government don't want to settle with the RMT is that the government understands the consequences of creating a precedent. This was freely admitted to a parliamentary committee by the Tory Transport Minister that the government feared an agreement with the rail workers because it would be followed by similar expectations by the NHS staff. Because of the success of the unions with their strikes and able to retain the sympathy of much of the public, the government are intending to pass new laws to hamstring the unions. Just like all previous efforts, such as when they brought in rules on ballots and pushed and picketed, these will ultimately fail to a great extent because the unions will manage to get around them. While I'm emphasising the positive sides of the strikers and applauding them, we have to also mention the limitations of strike action and the limitations that the trade unions are putting upon their goals, which are very moderate hopes. Unions are essential for the working class and have done much to advance its cause. Without them, workers would still be subject to the every whim of the employers. But unions, while indispensable in the struggle of the workers against capitalism, they do have the limits. We have to acknowledge that fact. For example, as the unions being moderate, let's look at the demands being made. During COVID lockdowns, government payments reinforced various proposed schemes for the UBI, you know, the conditional universal basic income. But these have all been put on the back burners now because with the inflation and the cost of living crisis, the demands have rightly returned to the battlefield of collective pay via trade union action. The weakness of the UBI was its dependency on the government action and policies, and it was recognised to be weak, while the union's strength is one of class power. So while we can full-heartedly offer our endorsement of our fellow workers in their various trade unions, there is an aspect that we must be sceptical and suspicious of. It is a campaign called Enough is Enough, which has been promoted by a number of unions, pressure groups, individual MPs. On their website, the demands which they declare as human rights are: one, a real pay rise and a minimum wage of £15 an hour. Two, to cut energy bills and nationalise the energy companies. Three, end food poverty by introducing free school dinners, for instance. Four, decent homes for all by capping rents and council's houses being built. And tax the rich being the last one, a wealth tax on the top 5%, closing loopholes in the non-domicile status, and calling for a higher and wider windfall tax on the likes of the oil companies. That's a rough gist of what they want. You can visit their website for a full explanation, wesayenough.co.uk. But over the years, these reforms have been repeated over and over and over again in some form or another. Clearly, the campaign Enough is Enough expect a new Labour government and all the newly elected Labour MPs to pass legislation and new laws. So it means that they will be campaigning for Labour Party in the next election, just as they always done, of course. But I don't think they even believe Starmer as Prime Minister will deliver. He won't even appear on their picket lines, much less deliver the promises that Enough Enough wants. But they do hold the hope that they can convince enough MPs to make them more receptive to their demands. But Starmer's agenda is the same old Blairite one. It's a new Labour to capture the middle ground voter. But as we see, the middle ground is becoming more and more polarised. They're becoming more and more militant. So what type of leverage can they exert upon Starmer, who under a new election will claim that he's got a mandate for his manifesto and not Enough is Enough's manifesto? MPs, no matter how sympathetic to Enough is Enough, won't destabilise a new Starmer government. It's all again a call for voting for the lesser evil, a Starmer government. While we can discern some positive developments in recent events, we can't ignore that still the workers are stopping short of wanting a real system change. They may believe that they're challenging the fundamentals of capitalism, but it's up to us to show that they really aren't. And I think this is a dilemma the party is facing. We have two options to choose from. First, to encourage and urge working class resistance through the unions to the cost of living crisis for the protection of our standard of living and paying working conditions, to show our solidarity with the acts that they are taking, the strikes. And it's something that we've always done. unlike some of the left communist groups who have always tried to distance themselves from the official trade union movement, we've never actually done that. But the problem is, as Marxists, I think we do have to rein on the parade to some extent. To some degree, we have to be realists. We have to point out the futility of the broader campaign to seek reforms from the Labour Party. We have to try and gauge our efforts to how much we devote to shooting down the unions and our fellow workers' delusions of a better government to come. We have to risk undermining the new confidence at a crucial time when people are rediscovering the power of economic and industrial organisation. And here we come along and say to them, all very good and well, but enough is not enough, as this month's Standard says. We are probably the only party that is willing to put our popularity at stake by acting as a wet blanket at a time when others are trying to raise optimism. I think we are the voice of socialist reason, and our propaganda walks this tightrope. We have to achieve a balance with the workers' actual struggle and their fight on one hand, and against the many supposed solutions that their leaders are bringing to the agenda. How do we communicate our cynicism and scepticism and still get a sympathetic hearing? How do we show solidarity and support but still express our disagreement and opposition? Should we emphasise our case against capitalism as our primary method of communication? Or alternatively, make our priority our case for socialism? Lesser evil politics always seems popular, but it fosters false solutions and brings forth non-socialist recruitment to all its various proponents. That is a dichotomy we face, if that's the right word. My own opinion is that whatever strengthens the potential power of the working class, what keeps it healthy and virile, is a benefit to it. And eventually to us in our efforts to achieve socialism, when we have a strong fellow workers in a fit state to heed our message. But more importantly, to reach their own socialist conclusions without necessarily hearing our voice. And we have to encourage this type of atmosphere of self-education, self-learning. I know some of you will have a lot more to add, especially some who are actually directly involved in the strikes and possess a lot more first-hand information and insight than I do. Usually the format is that the speaker gets asked questions and answers and comments on people's replies. I think every member here has a valid opinion worthy of being heard. My own reply to them are not required. So really it's up to the chair just to direct people's comments and not really have to turn to me for my opinion. And like I say, it's short and sweet because we're all here know a lot more about what's happening than me personally. So I'll end there.
Okay, thank you.